Hello, and welcome to the Kaiser Family Foundation's web briefing for the media on potential changes to healthcare access and coverage for women. I'm Amy Jeter, and I'm a member of the Foundation's communications team. Today, three Foundation experts will provide brief presentations on women's health. Alina Sloganikoff, who is the Foundation Vice President and the Director of Women's Health Policy, will discuss the potential impact on women of the Affordable Care Act repeal and replacement and possible changes to abortion regulations. Lori Sobel, an Associate Director on our Women's Health Policy team, will address potential changes to the Family Planning Safety Net and the impact of funding cuts to Planned Parenthood. And Ashley Kurtzinger, Senior Survey Analyst with our Public Opinion and Survey Research team, will present findings from our March tracking poll that reveal public opinion on these issues. This web briefing is being recorded and will be posted online afterward, along with the slides from the presentation. Everyone who has RSVP'd will receive notification when they're posted. The briefing is in listen-only mode. You can chat questions to the speakers at any time via the web interface. We'll answer questions during a Q&A period after the presentation. We'll start with Alina.
Great. Thank you, Amy. Today, what I'd like to do is to briefly touch on some of the key issues that repealing and replacing the ACA would mean for women. While most of the discussions and media coverage focusing on women has been centered on contraception, Planned Parenthood, and abortion, major concerns for women also include Medicaid, accessibility of coverage, affordability, and scope of benefits. It's important to note that there is talk of a three-pronged approach, with the Republican-sponsored American Healthcare Act being the first prong. It mostly deals with the coverage expansions, Planned Parenthood, and capping Medicaid, and tomorrow the House is scheduled to vote on it. Because it is a reconciliation bill, however, it can only address provisions that affect the federal budget. As a result, some of the ACA provisions and protections that have been important to women, such as insurance reforms, the essential health benefits package, and no-cost preventive care, are not addressed by the AHCA. Replacing and repealing these and other elements of the ACA that are important to women will require the other two prongs, executive action and future legislation, and will likely come up in the near future. Before we get into the details, it is important to consider how coverage has changed since the ACA was enacted. Between 2013 and 2015, the uninsured rate among women ages 19 to 64 fell from 17% to 11%, a record low. As you can see, coverage improvements were observed in all subgroups of women. In addition to coverage improvements, fewer women now face affordability barriers. The share of women who report that they delayed or went without care due to costs has fallen. This drop has been particularly marked among low-income women, although costs are still a greater challenge for this group of women. For low-income women in particular, one of the most important changes to the ACA was the Medicaid expansion. Historically, individuals who did not have children were typically ineligible for Medicaid, no matter how poor. For some, Medicaid eligibility was temporary. For example, many women who had a Medicaid birth lost their coverage 60 days postpartum. The ACA enabled new moms in Medicaid expansion states to stay on the program, giving them access to continuous coverage rather than becoming uninsured, as was the case in the past, and is still the case in non-expansion states. Today, nearly one in five women nationally are on Medicaid, but as you can see here, the range of coverage varies tremendously. This variation is largely due to the fact that states have made different decisions about eligibility levels and expanding Medicaid. Phasing out the expansion will change how this map looks in the future. Placing a cap on federal Medicaid spending could also shape the scope of services that women served by these programs receive. Before the Medicaid expansion, many states had eligibility levels that were extremely low. For example, in Indiana or Louisiana, a single mother of two would have been ineligible if she made more than $5,000 a year. And this is still the case in most of the states that did not expand Medicaid. And while this is a web briefing about women, it is worth noting that poor men would again be left with even fewer pathways to Medicaid coverage should the AHCA become law. The CBO estimated that the phase-out of the Medicaid expansion under the AHCA would be a major contributor to a dramatic increase in the number of uninsured Americans. There has been a lot of attention to the adequacy of subsidies that would be offered to help individuals afford private coverage under the AAHCA. Women comprise more than half of the current marketplace enrollees in the states that use healthcare.gov, and 8 of 10 of these marketplace enrollees receive a premium tax credit. Today, under the ACA, the level of subsidy is based on family income, cost of premiums, and age. Cost sharing, such as deductibles, coinsurance, and copayments, are capped for low-income individuals. In contrast, the AHCA provides a flat tax credit, which is based only on age and phases out at higher income levels. The manager's amendment did set aside additional federal funds to assist older enrollees to afford coverage, but how those funds are to be allocated will be determined by the Senate. Under the ACA's tax credit methodology, people with lower incomes would receive significantly less than they do under current law, and many would have higher deductibles. As has been well documented, women are more likely than men to be low income. They're more likely to work part year, are paid less than men for similar work, and take breaks from the workforce to stay home and care for children and aging parents. As a result, the AHCA methodology could disproportionately disadvantage women compared to the Affordable Care Act. Some of the ACA insurance reforms have enjoyed bipartisan support, particularly the ban on pre-existing condition exclusions and the dependent coverage provisions, and these are maintained in the AHCA. It also does not repeal the ban on gender rating. This ban prohibits individual plans from charging women more than men for the same coverage. It also maintains many changes to benefits that have improved the quality of coverage for pregnant women and new moms. This includes maternity care, no-cost prenatal visits and screenings, as well as breastfeeding support services, including breast pumps. Some other Republican plans, however, would repeal the essential health benefit and preventive services requirements that have shaped maternity care under the ACA. And this could be taken up under future legislation, and maternity care specifically has been discussed as a benefit for removal since men and older women don't use it. The prenatal screening services that I mentioned earlier are part of a package of recommended preventive services that nearly all plans must cover without charging cost sharing. Among the slate of no-cost services, many are exclusively for women, shown here in orange. Or some of them address the most common conditions affecting women, including cardiovascular disease, depression, substance abuse, and obesity. While the reconciliation limitations faced by the AHCA do not allow it to include a repeal of preventive services, both Speaker Ryan's plan and Secretary Rice's plan would repeal this provision. By far the most controversial preventive service has been contraceptive coverage, one of the recommended preventive services for women that is issued by HRSA, the Health Resources and Services Administration, an agency of the Department of Health and Human Services. Federal regulations stipulate that plans are required to cover without cost sharing each of the 18 methods of contraceptives approved by the FDA that are prescribed. This figure shows how quickly this provision had an impact on out-of-pocket spending for women, with the share of reproductive age women with any out-of-pocket spending on oral contraceptives falling to under 4% in just 2 years. Similar effects have been documented for other contraceptives, including IUDs. Following the election, there were reports of record numbers of women scheduling appointments to get IUDs, fearing the loss of this benefit. While this has not yet happened, in fact, contraceptive coverage could be eliminated or scaled back through administrative action. There is no need for congressional repeal. While the Obama administration, through HRSA, turned to outside groups to get recommendations for gaps on women, the Trump administration could change these by seeking recommendations from different groups or developing their own. They could also change the regulation and leave it up to employers or plans to make these determinations, which potentially could result in more limited coverage. This provision has been at the heart of two Supreme Court cases, which have involved employers who oppose some or all contraceptive methods on religious grounds. The Obama administration tried to thread the needle by devising an accommodation, assuring that women workers and dependents were entitled to contraception. It is worth noting that both President Trump and Secretary Price have stated that they want to prioritize the religious freedom of employers, and some are anticipating an executive order or new regulations to allow employers with religious objections to become exempt from the requirement in the same way that houses of worship are today. And of course, another controversial women's health issue is abortion. Since 1976, the federal Hyde Amendment has limited the use of federal funds for abortion only to cases when the pregnancy is a result of rape, incest, or is a threat to the woman's life. The ACA explicitly bars abortion from being defined as an essential health benefit and allows states to ban abortion coverage for all marketplace plans. And 25 states have done this. In states that permit abortion coverage, funds must be segregated to assure that no federal dollars are applied to abortion services. The AHCA would go further. It would establish a federal ban for abortion coverage in all marketplace plans and would prohibit the use of federal tax credits to purchase any plan that covers abortion, even those that are available outside the marketplace. The bill would disqualify small employers from receiving tax credits if their plans cover abortion beyond high limitations, and would prohibit the use of tax credits for all individuals seeking a COBRA policy after leaving a job if that plan includes abortion. This could have an impact of discouraging employers from including abortion coverage in their employees' health plans. While it does allow insurers to offer and individuals to buy separate abortion policies or riders, to my knowledge, these plans do not exist. So with that, I'm going to turn now to my colleague, Lori Sobel, who will review the issues facing the safety net of providers who provide reproductive health care services to low-income women.
Thank you, Alina. I'm going to talk about the funding of the safety net for reproductive health for women and what's at stake. I will cover Title X, Medicaid financing of family planning, and the potential impact of banning Medicaid reimbursement to Planned Parenthood. Where women receive family planning varies greatly by socioeconomic status. One third of low-income women obtain contraception from a publicly funded clinic, while this is the case for a very small share of higher-income women. So the funding of family planning clinics is essential for low-income women's access to family planning. The policies being debated about Medicaid and Title X will greatly affect low-income women. Title X is a national family planning program sponsored by the federal government and administered by the HHS Office of Population Affairs. It is the only federal program dedicated to supporting the delivery of family planning and related preventative health care. Title X funds safety net clinics in each state to provide family planning services to low-income, uninsured, and underserved clients. Title X clinics must follow a set of standards recommended by the National Quality Family Planning Guidelines. They must serve low-income patients on a sliding scale, provide clients with a broad range of contraceptive methods, and ensure that services are voluntary and confidential. The program provides a total of $285 million to more than 4,000 clinics. A variety of providers participate in the program, including Planned Parenthood, community health centers, health departments, as well as school-based, faith-based, and other private nonprofits. Recent proposals have included provisions to substantially decrease the budget for the Title X program. Most recently, President Trump's budget includes a substantial decrease to the HHS budget, which could affect the budget for Title X. As you see by this pie chart, the distribution of revenue sources for Title X clinics is the major. Medicaid reimbursement is 40%, while Title X funds are only 19%. In the last 6 years, Title funding has been cut by $31 million. Like private doctor's offices, clinics bill different payers, including Medicaid, for the services they provide to patients. In 2015, 66% of Title X clients had family incomes at or below the poverty level, 35% were covered by Medicaid or another public program, and nearly half were uninsured. Medicaid is the largest public payer for family planning services. Medicaid covers 1 in 5 women of reproductive age, and 70% of women on Medicaid are of reproductive age. Family planning services are mandatory benefits under Medicaid and must be provided free of cost. Under the AHCA, for states that select the block grant option, family planning services would no longer be a mandatory benefit for non-disabled women on Medicaid. There are other Medicaid provisions specific to family planning. Beneficiaries can choose any willing provider for family planning, even if they're in a managed care plan. Under current financing, the federal government pays for 90% of the family planning. This higher federal payment rate provides states with an incentive to cover the full range of contraceptive methods. The AHCA proposes to allow states to use a per capita cap. Under a per capita cap structure, states will still be required to cover family planning services, but there would no longer be an incentive to provide the most expensive contraceptive methods, even though they're shown to be the most highly effective at preventing unintended pregnancies like IUDs. In addition, unique to family planning, states are allowed to establish limited scope family planning programs. 27 states have chosen to have family planning programs with expanded eligibility. As you can see in this map, these states are across the political spectrum. They include red, blue, and purple states. These limited scope programs have allowed states to extend Medicaid coverage for family planning services to low-income women and men who do not have other family planning coverage. If a state chooses a per capita cap structure under the AHCA, the financing structure for standalone family planning expansions would not change. So these programs might become even more important given the other changes that are being proposed to Medicaid. Planned Parenthood is the primary safety net provider for many low-income women. As you can see in the graphic, despite making up only 10% of safety net clinics providing subsidized family planning services, Planned Parenthood served 36% of women seeking contraceptive care at safety net clinics in 2010. In comparison, F2HCs represent 38% of safety net clinics, yet served only 16% of women seeking contraceptive care. The AHCA includes a provision that bars Planned Parenthood from obtaining federal Medicaid reimbursement for health services provided for 1 year. The impact of this provision will differ by state. In some states, more than 50% of clients who obtained publicly supported family planning services were seen at Planned Parenthood clinics. Other states have a lower percentage of clients served at Planned Parenthood. The impact will depend on where there are other available clinics which can absorb the patient volume and provide the same range of services. Planned Parenthood clinics saw 2.4 million patients in 2015. The CBO's analysis of the AHCA stated that cutting off Medicaid payments to Planned Parenthood for 1 year would result in a loss of access to services in some low-income communities because it is the only public provider in some regions. The report also stated that the policy would result in thousands of additional unintended pregnancies that would be financed by Medicaid. A common theme among policy proposals to ban Medicaid reimbursement to Planned Parenthood or lower Title X funding is the redirection of funds to other providers, such as community health centers, with the expectation that other clinics could meet the needs of those formerly served by Planned Parenthood. It is unlikely that the community health clinics could increase their capacity to serve all the Planned Parenthood patients. In addition, as shown in the graph, Planned Parenthood clinics also typically facilitate access to a wider range of contraceptive methods than F2HC clinics provide. For example, 34% of F2HCs can provide initial supply refills of oral contraceptives on site, compared to 83% of Planned Parenthood clinics. Similarly, 83% of Planned Parenthood clinics report they can provide IUDs the same day. Only 30% of F2HCs provide same-day IUD insertion. So the range of services offered at Planned Parenthood is generally greater than the options offered at F2HCs. With that, I'm going to end and turn it over to Ashley to talk about our latest polling on women's health.
Thank you, Lori. I'm going to be presenting data from our most recent Kaiser Family Foundation tracking survey, which was conducted March 6th through 12th of this year. Overall, we find that there is still some lack of awareness surrounding ACA provisions for women's health and preventive care. 6 in 10 are aware that the ACA includes provisions that eliminate out-of-pocket costs for childhood preventive services, and about half are aware of the provisions that eliminate out-of-pocket costs for preventive care for adults and birth control. About 4 in 10 are aware of the gender rating provision, which prohibits insurance companies from charging women higher premiums than men. There is some variation by party, with Republicans less likely to be aware of the lack of cost sharing for preventive care
and the gender rating prohibition. Overall, a majority of the public also say it is important, either very or somewhat, that each of these provisions is kept in place if lawmakers decide to repeal the ACA and replace it with something else. As you can see, fewer say it is important to keep the provision eliminating cost sharing for contraception, but still about half say it is very important to keep this in place. Once again, we see differences by party, with a smaller share of Republicans saying it is important to keep all of these provisions in place than independents or Democrats who say the same. Large majorities of women, regardless of political party, say keeping most of these requirements in place is very important. One exception is the requirement that private health plans cover the cost of birth control with no cost sharing, which majorities of women who are Democrats and independents view as very important compared with a smaller share of Republican women. We also asked about awareness for the provision that requires all private health insurance plans purchased by individuals to include maternity care. 71% of Americans are aware that the ACA does this. In addition, as you can see on the slide, 89% of the public support this ACA provision. Views on this requirement are somewhat malleable. Participants in the survey received counterarguments once they stated their opinion on the issue. So those who said they supported the provision were asked if they still support it if they heard that the requirement meant some people would have to pay for benefits they do not use. As you can see, this shifted some attitudes, with a total of 32% of the public now saying they oppose this provision. On the other hand, 93% now support the requirement for all private health insurance plans to include maternity care, once those who originally opposed the requirement hear that without such a requirement, maternity care would become very expensive and unaffordable for some people. In addition to the requirement for health insurance plans to include maternity care, the ACA also requires private health insurance plans to cover the full cost of birth control, unless the employer has a religious objection. We find 7 in 10 Americans support this provision, including 89% of Democrats, 69% of independents, and about half of Republicans. The majority, 85% of women, who are under the age of 45, regardless of partisanship, support this provision. When asked whose responsibility it is to pay for this coverage for women who work for a company whose employer does not pay for coverage because of religious objections, similar shares say it is the individual woman's responsibility, as say it is the insurance company's responsibility. Fewer say it is the responsibility of the federal government. Democrats and independents are more likely to say it is either the government or the insurance company's responsibility, while Republicans are more likely to say it's the women's responsibility. Turning to federal funding for reproductive health services, such as family planning and birth control for lower income women, we find 82% of the public say it is important to them that the federal government provides this funding. As you can see, about half of Republican men say it is important compared to 3/4 of Republican women. Large shares of Democratic and independent men and women say it is important to them that the federal government provides this funding. In addition, 3/4 of the public think that Medicaid should continue to pay Planned Parenthood for reproductive health and preventive care services provided to people on Medicaid, including birth control, STI testing and treatment, and cancer screening. The question wording clarifies that federal Medicaid funds cannot be used to pay for abortions. When we look at this among certain subgroups, you can see about half of Republican men and women say Medicaid should continue paying Planned Parenthood for non-abortion services, compared to about 3/4 of independents and about 9 in 10 Democrats. Among the women in our survey who have ever visited a Planned Parenthood clinic for health services, 88% say that federal Medicaid payments should continue. The survey also included questions asking awareness of the type of services provided by Planned Parenthood. The majority of the public are aware that Planned Parenthood provides contraceptions, STI testing and treatment, preventive care, and abortions. Yet 1/3 of the public are aware of the ban on federal Medicaid funds being used to pay for abortions. Awareness is slightly lower among Republicans, both men and women, with about one-fourth of these groups saying they are aware of the ban, compared to one-third of Democratic men and independent men, and about 4 in 10 Democratic and independent women. Drawing on attitudes toward federal Medicaid payments to Planned Parenthood and overall awareness of the ban, we find that attitudes towards federal payments to Planned Parenthood are largely stable, with few opinions changing after hearing counterarguments. About one-third oppose federal payments to Planned Parenthood once they hear that while no payments go directly to abortion services, the organization does provide and refer women for abortions. On the other hand, support for continuing payments to Planned Parenthood can go up to 82% once those who originally said Medicaid should stop all payments hear that stopping such payments could make it difficult for many lower-income women to access certain health care services.
Thank you so much, Ashley and Lori and Alina. We'll now answer questions that were submitted via the chat function. There's still time to send in your questions. Once again, the web briefing is being recorded and will be posted online on the slides on kss.org after the fact. Our first question comes from Suzanne Cervenka. Several states cut their family planning budgets in recent years. What has the impact been to care for women in those states? And how likely are those outcomes to occur nationally if the Title X funding is cut? Would it be similar outcomes, or better or worse?
Well, some of the states have actually, this is Alina Selganikoff, some of the states have scaled back their family planning expansion programs. These are limited scope programs that provide only family planning services to women who don't have other types of coverage. The issue is that those states have expanded their Medicaid full scope programs, and so some of those services, most of those services that were covered by the expansion programs are now covered by Medicaid. If the expansion program were to be scaled back, the Medicaid full scope expansion were to be scaled back, those women would not have a current expansion family planning program. I know it's confusing to go to. Title X provides support to the clinics, and so the Title X would be even more important in terms of providing coverage for family planning services for low-income women, as well as providing supports to the clinics in terms of payment for infrastructure and other services.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Kara Lofton of West Virginia Public Broadcasting. She asked, is federal funding for women's health services separate from the state's decision to expand Medicaid?
This is Lori Sobel. The Title X funding is from the federal government. As I mentioned, it's from HHS, the Office of Population Affairs. Yes, states' decisions to expand Medicaid are separate from that funding.
Okay. Next question from Allie Bogan from Rewire. She says, when discussing the birth control benefit, she says, I believe you mentioned that the decision of what to cover would be pushed back to employers. Could what you're describing fairly be considered a cafeteria plan? And if so, do you think it could be extended by employers, insurers, beyond the birth control benefit to areas such as mental health coverage or maternity care?
This is Alina Selganikoff. I am really not sure exactly how to answer your program. I do think that if it is pushed back to employers, if we look back to employer coverage of contraceptives, it actually was covered by around 85% of large employers. There was, however, no requirement for no-cost contraceptive coverage. So while the plans covered it, they wouldn't be necessarily required to cover every single one of the plans and cover it without cost sharing. So we're likely to see that happen if this provision is repealed. In addition, states have laws that require state-regulated plans to offer contraceptive coverage. I think that there is over half of the states have these laws, although only 6 states have laws that require coverage for no-cost coverage of contraceptives.
All right. And Lori, you had mentioned that the AHCA eliminates federal Medicaid payments to Planned Parenthood for 1 year only. Do you have any sense of why exactly it is for 1 year and what could happen to federal funding through Medicaid after 1 year?
Sure. So what our assumption is, and others have commented as well, is that the reduction for 1 year is based upon the scoring. So the CBO, when they score it for only 1 year, they come out with the overall savings for the Medicaid program, even though the reduction in reimbursement to Planned Parenthood would result in increased Medicaid births. But for 1 year, it ends up with savings. If you do it for a longer time period, which the CBO did in 2005, you end up with
2015.
I'm sorry, 2015. You end up with much greater cost to the Medicaid program.
All right, thank you. Our next question comes from Carla Shepherd Rubinger, excuse me, of the Academy of Women's Health. She is asking, are breastfeeding supports in jeopardy in the new plan, the AHCA, would they be optional?
Breastfeeding supports are not in jeopardy in the AHCA. That is because they are part of the preventive services that are required under the ACA, and they cannot be repealed using a reconciliation approach. So they are currently not in jeopardy. Should future legislation repeal the preventive services requirements, then they could be in jeopardy, but they are currently not.
Okay. Next question comes from Lindy Washburn, who is with The Record in the North Jersey Media Group, the USA Today Network. She asks, if we could talk about which types of birth control are most common and whether that varies by geography, income, age, what would be the cost to consumers for those methods if they didn't have coverage, including which would be the most expensive?
Yeah, I mean, we don't have specific data on exactly which are most common. We can speak to that IUDs and other long-lasting contraceptive methods have become more popular now that they are offered without cost sharing under the ACA. The cost for that will depend on where women receive them, but generally an IUD can cost about $1,000.
Yeah, the pill is actually still the most commonly used contraceptive method. As Lori mentioned, there is, you know, the IUDs can be very expensive, but over time, actually, you know, you can have an IUD for 5 to 7 years, so that it does become much more cost effective than other methods would be. So there are differences by income and by age, and we can follow up with more specific data on that, but that is available.
Okay, thank you. The next question comes from Lena Tillett, who is with WRAL in Raleigh, North Carolina. She asks, what other preventive services would be reduced or potentially cut for women if the American Healthcare Act stops the Medicaid reimbursement to Planned Parenthood for a year?
This is Lori responding. The preventative services, as Alina mentioned, aren't changed in the AHCA, so the actual coverage for them wouldn't change, but of course Planned Parenthood provides a lot of those preventative services to women, so the access to those, even though they would still be covered for people who are still insured by plans covered by the ACA, would change. And so there's concern that there would be a loss in access for women if the funds, the Medicaid reimbursement to Planned Parenthood were banned.
And those services would include, this is Alina, STI screenings, cancer screenings, in some cases well woman visits, in addition to contraception.
Okay. Our next question comes from Heather Berner, who is a freelance journalist. She asks, does the American Healthcare Act propose changes to the CMS innovations that seek to cover complex care under bundled payments for women and others who have multiple chronic conditions?
The AHCA actually doesn't specifically provide changes to the CMS Innovations Program, so that at this point has not been is not an issue right now for women or for anybody.
Okay. Another question, Alina, you had mentioned that there are some other proposed GOP proposals that would eventually repeal the essential health benefits and preventive services through private health plans. And I was wondering if you could speak to what the impact would be were that to occur on women.
Yeah, the if you review some of the other GOP proposals, and actually KFF.org has a very nice interactive, there's a little plug there, feature that allows you to compare the different proposals. Both Secretary Ryan, Secretary Price and Speaker Ryan have proposed ACA repeal and replacement plans. Both of these would proposals would eliminate the essential health benefits requirement for individually purchased plans and would eliminate the preventive services requirements as well for all plans. And so losing those coverages for in the individual market, losing maternity care for women would take us back to basically where women had to purchase riders. And sometimes very costly riders to get those unless states had a law that banned that. And it would require that individuals pay for many of the preventive services that are currently covered without cost sharing, because those requirements would be repealed. And that would not just affect individual plans. And this is an area where people do, there is a lot of confusion. The preventive services requirements affect most of the people probably listening to this call, unless you are, it's almost everybody. It's those with individual plans, those with employer plans, Medicaid expansion, and there are even for women who are on Medicare as well.
Okay, thank you. Another question from Lindy Washburn, who would like to know, how is the morning after pill covered by Medicaid? Is it as a prescription drug, and would that change?
So we recently did a survey and found that the morning after pill, which is also called emergency contraception, is typically covered in most states by the Medicaid plans. The states can determine which types of contraceptives they would like to cover for their non-expansion populations. But there are some gaps with states less likely to cover. There are two products, Ella and another one that's most commonly known, Plan B, which is also available over the counter. And states are less likely to cover Ella, which is the more effective method and is only available with a prescription.
All right. Our next question comes from Janet Burns of Forbes. She asks, do you have a sense of the cost associated with maternal care following Medicaid births, when the women are no longer Medicaid eligible, as, for example, care through increased ER visits or long-term care?
To my knowledge, that specific question hasn't been answered by research. I mean, when we talk about the services that are that women get, what you would really lose is a lot of the kind of important preventive services, preconception or interconception care, things that women need to do to be healthy mothers, to have healthy children, as well as to prepare should they want to have a subsequent pregnancy to be healthy for that pregnancy. So the emergency visits, if they're uninsured, would be absorbed by the system, mostly the safety net providers that women would have to use. And so those costs would be real but wouldn't necessarily come up as Medicaid costs.
Thank you. Just a reminder, we're still accepting questions via the chat function, and we're happy to respond to any of your queries. We have another question now from Megan Maltini from Wired. She says, does the American Healthcare Act eliminate the Affordable Care Act, Prevention and Public Health Fund? And if so, what would be the biggest impacts for women and children?
Oh, were you going to answer that now? To my knowledge, I don't believe it specifically eliminates the Prevention and Public Health Act fund. That fund basically does support, it hasn't been well utilized and there have been other cuts. I think that the biggest impact for women and children would be the loss of the Medicaid expansion and the loss of subsidies for low-income families.
Our next question comes from Jenny Kane. She's from UC Berkeley Graduate School of Journalism. She asks, do you have any information on how the rate of unwanted pregnancies might increase if reimbursements to Planned Parenthood are discontinued for a year? What is the economic cost for an individual with an unwanted pregnancy? and what would the cost tend to be for a provider or insurer?
Well, the CBO's, this is Lori, the CBO's analysis of the AHCA stated that cutting off Medicaid payments to Planned Parenthood 1 year would result in a loss of access to services. It also stated the policy would result in thousands of additional unintended pregnancies that would be financed by Medicaid. So that's the best estimate we have on that. I'm not sure about the part of the question that you were asked about the cost to other insurers. They wouldn't be, people who were previously going to Planned Parenthood wouldn't necessarily then be able to access services through another insurer. There would probably be a rise in uncompensated care provided at hospitals, though, so that would probably rise.
And this is Alina, and I do think we have some evidence when we look at what happened in Texas, when Texas eliminated Planned Parenthood as a provider from its expansion program, where we did see increases in unintended pregnancies and women having more difficulties to access contraceptive services.
Great, thank you. Another question from Heather Berner, who's a freelance journalist. She's asking, would our experts be able to comment on the effects of the American Health Care Act on women living with HIV and at risk for HIV? She says that, for instance, Planned Parenthood is beginning to provide HIV prevention drugs to women and gay men.
Well, if we look at the AHCA, both in terms of what it would do in terms of reducing access to coverage, the Medicaid, a lot of the individuals who, and women in particular, who are HIV positive are low-income women. They rely very heavily on Medicaid to get the full scope of services that they need. Planned Parenthood is increasingly, you're correct, offering HIV services and has been a longstanding provider of care to women. Should Medicaid not be included as a participating provider, then in many cases, women with Medicaid, HIV positive women with Medicaid, would be more restricted in the range of providers that are able to meet their needs. And individuals with HIV have very specific health care needs, and Planned Parenthood and providers who focus on HIV have been really trained to deal with those issues. So losing Planned Parenthood could restrict access for women, particularly depending on the community in which they live, if there are no other HIV providers available.
Thank you. Just another reminder, we are available to continue to answer any questions you may have with regards to women's health and potential changes in the coming year. Just chat in your lower left-hand corner. Okay. And for the moment, it looks like we have answered the questions that have come our way. I wanted to remind you that there are a number of different resources on KFF.org that address potential changes that could be coming through the new Congress and the Trump administration, including a new brief that was posted today called 10 Ways That Repealing and Replacing the Affordable Care Act Could Affect Women. We also have the tracking poll that Ashley Kurtzinger mentioned today that was released just last week with the public's opinions on many of the existing provisions of the Affordable Care Act and some of the proposals in the American Health Care Act. We do have a follow-up question from Heather Berner, who's a freelancer. She is asking, are there any thoughts about the rise in STIs as a result of the American Health Care Act?
This is Lori. I mean, I think that if people have less access to safety net clinics, there could potentially be a rise in STIs. We've seen this in some states that have already cut coverage, access to Planned Parenthood, that there was less access to services and that STIs did, in fact, rise. So, you know, it's speculative, but I think that with people will have less access and, to services, STIs could potentially rise.
Thank you, Lori. And I wanted to get back to Ashley to talk a little bit more about the polling results. Ashley, why do you think there's still a lack of awareness about Affordable Care Act provisions now that we're coming upon the 7-year anniversary of the signing of the law?
Yeah, this is Ashley. We actually find that there's an overall lack of knowledge of what the ACA did, not just in terms of women's health care and preventive care, but about a variety of different provisions related to the ACA. And so it's not surprising that there's a lack of awareness among these provisions about women's health care as well. One of the big things that's driving this is the party ID. We're finding that Democrats and independents are more likely to be aware of ACA provisions than Republicans. So perhaps some messaging around the Affordable Care Act and how it impacted people's health has something to do with the partisanship of this country.
Thank you, Ashley. And it looks as though we have talked through the questions that you all have brought to us. Once again, we have some resources available for you for your reference on KFS.org. And once again, there will be a recording of the briefing available on KFS.org by or before tomorrow. If you had a question we didn't get to or that you think about after the fact, you may contact Katie Smith, our communications associate, for a follow-up, and her information is on your screen. And once again, as I mentioned, we have some new related resources with regard to women's health care, a brief that came out just today on these 10 ways that repealing and replacing the ACA could affect women, which includes some of the data and information that we spoke about today. And we also have the poll from last week, which will be soon summarized in the chart pack, specifically on public opinion and survey research on women's health issues. You can find these on kfs.org or also follow us on Twitter or Facebook. Once again, thank you for attending.